person who feels like this isn't Christmas week. We're doing our holidays a little different this year with our gifts, and so there wasn't as much shopping, and maybe that's it. Maybe it's the weather. Either way, it just this doesn't... I don't feel like I'm about to be going on Christmas break. This doesn't feel like Christmas week. I can't shake it. I just feel it. Wake up. Once you see it turn, once you start to see it go, it's now in the 20s in December. You go, okay, it's real. It's shape-up time. And listen, still, nothing. No feel of it whatsoever. I don't know if I'm going to feel it sitting down at Christmas dinner this year. Anyway. Up and down day yesterday for the city of Toronto. Little Leafs trade, start things off. And then a Raptors comeback that still ends up in six straight losses for them. I'll start with Malgin because I don't have a ton on this. I'm just gonna kind of get the few thoughts I do have off my chest on this, and then I'll move into Raptors. I got David Thorpe and he'll just give us a real educated look at what's happening with the Raptors. He's someone who watched Scotty Barnes very closely at Florida State, was very high on Scotty Barnes at Florida State, liked him in the draft, thought that the Raptors nailed the pick. Definitely nobody thinks that they didn't nail the pick now, but yeah, it's been a pretty severe sophomore slump. He really hurt them again last night. He and Fred VanVleet, don't look at their combined stat lines. But yeah, Coach Thorpe, very well connected with the Raptors, very intelligent basketball mind, and someone who knows a lot about defense too. So, hey, Raptors played it last night for the first time in a while, but It has not looked that way against the vast majority of their opponents for a really long stretch. Okay, but Malgin first. Leafs trade him. I'll admit, I was actually surprised that they were even able to get anything for him at all. So congrats to Kyle Dubas for that. I don't think that the player they got in return, Dryden Hunt, is some type of world beater. The charts have indicated that he is certainly not that. But the charts also thought David Kampf was a nobody. The charts, if you looked at those things when he first came into town, it was, hey, this guy is mega low event. Anyway, I don't think Dryden Hunt is as good as David Kampf was, and he's not a center, and he's not going to come in with that kind of upside. But I like that they went out and got a guy that has a little bit of bite. Boy, the highlight of him just eviscerating poor Nosek in a scrap earlier this year is vicious and brutal. So I like that he brings a little bit of that. Good, responsible defensive forward that hits people. Pretty simple scouting report. And what we know about Kyle Dubas is that he's been trending in this direction for quite some time. This isn't a new thing to the Leafs. Yeah, they continue to accumulate the small skill guy, the Malgins of the world. They give them a shot. They keep trying to find one. They just want to hit on one of those guys so badly. God, would they just love it? Would they just love if they could hit on some overlooked small player who plays up front and has skill? It would validate all of this. All of these shots, all these long shots, all these picks, whatever. And the weird part about Malgin, or the part that I can't shake about Malgin anyways, is that maybe, just maybe, in trying to find something in the small skill guy that might have been overlooked by all the other NHL teams, that makes you find your own Marchessault, right? You find your own guy that does things differently, and you went out, found a skill player around the fringes. Boy, what a difficult thing it would be to do. Is that maybe the story here isn't, oh, the Leafs are giving up on this guy too soon, who flashed for a minute, right? Malgin had a little run. He had a little moment in the sun. First couple weeks of the season, people thought, oh, wow, with all the down about the Maple Leafs, the guy on the fourth line is actually giving them a bit of a spark. But yeah, now he's gone 17 games without a goal. So I don't really know what to say there. He's also gotten to play with two of the world's greatest hockey players and still isn't producing any points, I think, for 11 straight games. So no, I don't think that this is too soon, writing off Dennis Malgin. If you think that, fine. He goes to Colorado. He rips it up. Kyle Dubas will never sleep again because, again, this is something that he really, really, really wants to hit on. But the idea of going out and getting a defensively responsible, gritty fourth liner not new. That's something they've wanted for a while. It's something that they wanted with Kubel. This guy actually seems like just a straight-up Kubel replacement in a lot of ways. But the thing that I can't shake looking at the Malgin trade is whether or not it actually did hurt them in finding the small, skilled, overlooked guy. And yeah, Nick Robertson was a second-round pick. He tore it up in junior. He put up a ton of stats basically his entire life. So he's not exactly the Dennis Malgin mold, who, by the way, scored less in the Swiss League than I thought he did. He was like barely over a point a game. That kind of shocked me. I went, what? So, huh? I would just assume that he was Wayne Gretzky over there, but okay. But yeah, a little bit of revisionist history for me. I thought that the Leafs really needed to keep Nick Robertson coming out of camp. He was awesome. He was a man on fire. He had come into the preseason and looked great and had a lot of confidence and was just rolling in the right direction. And a lot of people thought, okay, good. Finally, something's really happening here for him. And I mentioned it. Normally, you don't make the team out of training camp. And the idea that you have you're going to be able to avoid waivers always helps. That you can go on a two-way deal and go back down to the Marlies and that they want to keep a pro. I'm not saying that this was so stupid. Oh my God, this was so stupid. But I did think this at the time. I really did. I thought, if this kid comes in here and he's a real future piece of your organization, and maybe he isn't, maybe he was never going to be, but don't you want to give him more of a look than the, you know, retread veteran that you keep trotting back out here? That, okay, fine. And Malgin started well, and it seemed okay. But then you had Robertson sort of up and down and in this limbo, and then he wasn't playing for a little while, and he couldn't get back in the roster, and then he does come back in, and he looks like a kid who's pressing a little bit. It wasn't a good formula. And part of me will always wonder, with the Malgin thing, is what would it have looked like if they just decided, you know what, Dennis Malgin, we're going to let you go. We're going to try to make this trade happen early in the year, whatever. And we're going to roll with the kid. The kid showed up. He's a long-term piece. We're going to take a look at him. We've seen what confidence has done for Rasmus Sandin playing more minutes. And granted, he's shown a lot more at the NHL level earlier. He showed a lot more even at some international competition, whatever, than Nick Robertson did. But yeah, I'll think about it. And I'll think about it probably until Nick Robertson either lands somewhere else in a trade or actually has some success in the NHL, whatever. One of those two things happening, it negates this. I don't think that it's everything. It's just something to ponder. Anyway, I don't mind the trade for the Leafs. And there's not much to say about Dryden Hunt, like I mentioned. He's got 14 goals in 193 games. He can beat the brakes off of somebody every once in a while. And he's going to hit more than any Toronto Maple Leafs player outside of Zach Aston-Reese. He and Zach Aston-Reese are essentially carbon copies of each other, except for Reese probably has a little bit more offensive upside, which, as we know, isn't a lot. Anyway, speaking of offensive upside, Raptors. Kind of encouraging and discouraging night all at the same time, right? Siakam had looked off for the last couple of games. He really wasn't finishing in the same way. A couple of bad offensive habits. And then he shows up and he puts the Raptors team on his back against the Sixers and decides, yeah, we're not just going to get punked again tonight. We're going to do something here. He has a 16-point third quarter. He drags them back into the fight. He basically, I think he loves playing against Joel Embiid. I think the Cameroon thing, he gets up for it in a special way. And he did. He did in that game. He's hitting that long range two with real effectiveness. Just the jump shot looked great for Siakam, and he was aggressive going to the basket. It was just the perfect combination of when that dude is on, right? And then, once again, the other guys around him can't really sync up, and you're waiting. You're just waiting for somebody else. There's a couple of fluky Chris Boucher shots that drop. Going, okay, that's something. OG hits a couple shots. He comes back. That's decent. But ultimately, once again, the Raps just they can't sync up with their star players. Fred struggles again from the floor, a lot of wide open looks that he ends up bricking. Scotty Barnes, another night where he's not playing with the joy that we're used to seeing from the rookie of the year. And the Raptors find a way to lose a game, and some people are talking about it being encouraged, and I understand that because they actually played some defense last night. But It's hard for me to go and talk about the moral victories or the step forward when, yeah, you've got the loss to Sacramento, who is on the second half of a back-to-back, and you had a big lead on. You have the two Orlando games in a row on this losing streak, and you have Golden State missing their two best players. And, yeah, you get smoked by them on your home floor. Schedule coming up for the Raptors isn't any easier either. They've got the Knicks, who I think have won 7 straight games. They've got the Knicks, and then they've got the Cavs, who they've done like shockingly well against this season. They just match up really well against the Cavs for some reason, although last time they didn't have Jared Allen, so maybe that helped them quite a bit. Then they've got the return of Kawhi, so we'll see if he plays, but yeah, if he does, you're probably not going to be favored there. Then you got the Grizzlies. Then you got the Suns. That's kind of a murderer's row. And okay, one game against the Pacers, who are right there with you in the standings. But then the Milwaukee Bucks come to town on January 4th. So I really do believe that this is going to be a really tough stretch for this Raptors team. And if they can show something, then maybe they end up pivoting in the direction that nobody sees coming right now. But yeah, as of right now, it's hard to be optimistic about the team. Anyway, a man who knows a lot more than I do, one of my favorite guys to talk basketball with, David Thorpe, skills and life coach, author at True Hoop, incredibly accomplished guy. His book is called Basketball is Jazz, which you can get wherever books are sold. David, good morning. Thanks for making time, man.
Oh, my pleasure.
So let's just start with this. Raptors, I don't know how much of the game you caught last night, but they actually were able to get some stops. This has been a hallmark of the team, has been defense and toughness, and it's kind of gone away this season. I'm curious what you're seeing.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't really watch Toronto a whole lot anymore because they stink. And there's 30 teams in this league, and I really try to focus on the better teams. I'd pay attention. They certainly have talented players, and there's a lot of talk, you know, in my world about what are they going to do? Are they going to buy some talent, meaning trade? Are they going to move some guys and maybe kind of rejigger the lineup or just scrap it all up, which I don't think would be the case. But I think that it's a parity-driven league, and we've got more good teams and maybe no phenomenal teams, but it means you've got to play incredibly well every single night. And I do question whether or not the team really believes they can be special. And when you don't have that belief in a league like you have right now where every game's a battle, that loss of spirit, even just 1%, 2%, 3% less for a team like Toronto that's built to overwhelm you with a ferocious defense and attacking the glass and racing in transition, just missing a little bit deflates them significantly, more so than they would maybe another team that doesn't play the way Toronto plays, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. You're being asked to play a high-intensity game. You're being asked to do a ton. And a lot falls on the core players, right? Nick Nurse plays the same group of guys a lot. And so I could see how, yes, that wears on you and wears on you and wears on you. And so, yeah, I don't think that it's surprising that we're seeing that with the Raptors. I guess the tougher one is, I saw a quote. I can't remember which Raptor said it because it lines up with sort of what you were saying about how they do feel like a team sometimes in two different directions. And, yeah, you lose a little bit of that identity of where you're supposed to be going, and it can really hurt you as a group. I guess how long can you continue to run that out there if you're a management group before you have to actually make a significant change?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I'll remind you, right around a year ago, I could look it up. I wrote an article at True Hoop about Jason Tatum. If you remember, you may not, because it seems to be impossible to imagine, but Jason Tatum was struggling, and the Celtics were struggling. And I didn't know why. Right. I didn't know why they were struggling. And my partner, Henry Abbott, said, can you watch tape and can you study data and tell me why the Celtics are kind of sticky? And so I said, yeah. So I broke down and saw that, well, Tatum isn't doing what he needs to do. And I didn't know why. And so I watched a lot of tape and I saw that, he's just missing shots he tends not to miss. And it seems super simplistic, but the article is basically everything's just fine in Boston. They just need Tatum to make the shots he normally makes. And he probably will. I didn't talk about law of averages necessarily. Just great players tend to shoot great. And if they're not shooting well early on, give it time. So I don't get paid to run the Raptors. that's what they need to be doing from a coaching and management perspective, is where are we going wrong and can we fix that? And if we can, great. If we can't, well, then you have to make some moves. And I'm sure they'll look at – they got to start with Siakam, but I think they'll quickly find out that, generally speaking, he's been amazing, so he isn't the answer. My guess is – oh, they'll look at OG. And my guess is they'll think, well, OG's actually playing pretty well. He's trending in the right direction. And then you follow Scotty and Fred. And that's where I think they'll begin to find – some of their problem is they're not producing like they were. And so then the question becomes, well, how do we get them back? What do we do strategically in terms of X and O? How about systemically in terms of the overall identity and how we're playing, our kind of our brand? And then the other part would be you're playing, like, I don't know why Koloko, did anyone ever say why Koloko was starting for that team? He's a bad player. He's going to be good maybe. He's not good now. And yet he was playing. It's hard to win in this league of parity when you have anyone on the court that shouldn't be on an NBA court. It's very hard to win those games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, depth has been an issue for this team, and rim protectors have been an issue. And this is what's kind of funny about the philosophy of Project 6'9", as they call it, right? Where they've said, hey, we just want to accumulate as many 6'9" wings with wingspan, and we're going to try to build out our team this way, is... Well, how secure are you in that when the rookie second-round pick 7-footer, you're desperate to start, you know? It just feels, like you probably want a little bit more rim protection on your team, but also it seems like a pretty big reach when you're asking that kid to do it. So, you know, I saw a tweet from you a little while back. I was going through your stuff, and you posted, I think it was about the Pacers. It was, you know, winning breeds winning. And I thought about that just because That's basically been the Raptors' philosophy. That's been a Masai core tenant since they kind of tried to strip it down in the We the North era, where they almost made the Lowry trade to the Knicks. It doesn't work out. The rest is history, right? And from that point forward, the Raptors decide not to be a tank team. The Florida season, I think, is a big-time anomaly, especially given all their injuries, all the different things that happened, not having home court advantage. They didn't try to openly tank that season. They got hit with a lot of different weird circumstances. I just wonder if you think that these guys will deviate from that philosophy, if push comes to shove. Because you mentioned it, it's a parity league, and so you can still get into a playing game. This team is not horrific. Even if you trade a piece or two, it's hard to envision them becoming a team that's like with, you know, like what the Wizards are showing right now or the Bulls, where you're just lifeless every night, right? Where there's just absolutely no chance. Do you think that they might deviate from the winning breeds winning philosophy that they've been so staunch supporting for the last 6-7 years?
I mean, I don't know. They aren't far away from being a bottom four lottery team. And if they want to do that, they can certainly get in the Victor sweepstakes. That wouldn't be hard to do. Because it's just every night almost. There's only a few teams that really are bad this year. But even they, like the NBA team, have some danger players to it. You see what Orlando's doing right now. Things can change quickly the other way. But to do the same thing over and over again over the course of years, and I don't mean trying to win, but I mean strategically playing the way the Raptors are playing and hoping the result will be different without some kind of tweaks would be, you know, pretty crazy. I've not talked to Masai for 1 second or texted him during the season. The last we texted was, I think, preseason game one, maybe. I don't like the idea of tanking. I like the idea of keep trying to win. I agree with you totally on the Tampa experience. It was just terrible luck, and their best player was sick and Pascal and lost all that weight and whatever. That's all been reported. I think they've got some really good core pieces. OG and Pascal right now, obviously no one in the world was higher in Scotty Barnes than I was. I'm not so high in him right now. I don't know what's going on. I know that as we talked about the league being so tough as a team, and so it's hard to win games when you're employing players on the court that aren't really NBA players yet, or maybe even ever. There's no crystal ball that tells me Koloko is going to be a good NBA player one day. He might be, but that day isn't today and won't be tomorrow. So when you play guys like him, you can't expect to do well. I don't think anyway. But the same principle applies to the player. So Scotty was Rookie of the Year. He was the flavor of the month, the flavor of the season, and no one gives a darn. Like, all those guys want to crush him. All those 29 other teams want to kill him. They want to beat the Raptors and embarrass Scotty Barnes. That's just the way this league is. These are competitive dudes. And so I've been saying this all along, that A, I don't know what he did in the offseason, but it didn't seem like he worked on the game the way he should have. And B, you can't just show up on occasion, bring all your energy, and have success and expect the next night for the same thing to happen absent that same amount of energy. You have to always play. I talk to my players all the time about this. I have a very simple phrase: stay humble or be humbled. It's either way, either you're going to stay humble or someone's going to humble you because you didn't put in the work or you didn't put in the energy and the focus required to outplay those opponents on that night. And that comes every day, taking care of your body, getting your rest, watching your film, all that kind of stuff. This is human nature. This is the way it happens. I think Anthony Edwards ran into this for year three. He made a big jump from year one to year two, and we've not seen that same jump. The guys like John Morant and Luka Doncic that have kept ascending through those first three seasons and then beyond, they're amazing because it's hard. In fact, it's hard to go from good to great. It's harder to go from great to elite, I think. And those guys have done it. Pascal has done it. Kawhi did it years ago. We've not seen Scotty do that at all. Evan Mobley has gotten a little bit better. But I don't think he's complacent. I just think it's really hard. And so it takes some time. They've got a lot of work to do. But I would not be surprised to see Toronto. I don't know that they'll want to trade their three big wings. Everyone seems to want those guys. But if they decide to do that, they're going to get some really good players in return, and they'll just be a different-looking team.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that they'd be able to get the value back for any of those guys. Again, you can't go from an offseason where you're telling the entire NBA that Scotty Barnes is untouchable and have a record this way where he gets moved, so I think that's off the table. Siakam's been so incredible. Like you just mentioned, the going from great to elite and how rare it is in the NBA, and especially for a guy who was his 27th overall pick. And yeah, he's just incredibly impressive. It's impossible for me to envision a trade that works around him. And then you've got OG Anunoby, who for a stretch of the season, people were talking about being a defensive player of the year and someone who can knock down a corner three. Again, tough to find value for those guys. Tough not to think that that's the better option with your core moving forward. But the Scotty thing is super interesting what you said, because Brooklyn was in town about 4 or 5 days ago. And I can't remember if it was Kevin Durant or Kyrie Irving, but they had a quote about that too, about off seasons and complacency and having to work extremely hard. And I think it was in reference to Barnes. And yeah, do you just think that like this is a bad off season? This is beyond a sophomore slump, that some of this is complacency?
Yeah, the sophomore slump is really nothing, because not everyone experienced it. Like I said, Luka and John Morant, Trae Young, none of those guys had any problems. And they were probably every bit as good, if not better than Scotty as rookies. It has a lot to do with the arrogance of, oh, I can just keep doing this and be successful like I was the rookie. And it just isn't the case. It's harder in year two because teams are targeting you more and focused on you more. You're drawing better defensive assignments. At both ends, you're guarding better players. They're guarding with you with better players. They're scheming for you more. Players are thinking about you more and watching film on you more. This is the nature of the beast that is the NBA, and you can't take your eye off it, so to speak. You have to embrace it. I read a quote from Pascal the other day. I don't typically read about the Raptors, but I saw the headline, and basically, he sounded like exactly what you want your leader to say. We're not pointing fingers. It starts with us. It starts with the guys in the locker room. He said all the right things. Knowing him a little bit, I believe that he was telling the truth. And I think last night, I didn't see the game, but he played amazing, I heard, because he had not been playing as well for a little bit. And so that's a great bounce back game for him. And so now it's up to Scotty's got to do the same thing. And I will push back on one thing, though. I do think they can get great value for OG. Scotty's different. Scotty, we don't know what he is. So if you end up trading him, you're going to get quality players. But if he ends up being the star we thought he could be 3 months ago, and you're not getting that star quality back in return, that's where you lose the trade. But OG is trending in the right direction right now. I'm not saying you should move him. I'm just saying you should take phone calls. I'm sure they are. because he might be able to give you what you need in some other positions. They're, you know, Fred's struggling at the one. They have no real backup one. They have no five that can play. There are backup centers in this league who are starting or playing good amounts because of injury, and they're all better than anyone Toronto has, but they chose to go with the guys they wanted. They have at center now, and that's clearly not working out. So I think OG is one of the more interesting pieces that could be involved in trade discussions and end up being traded and really helping the Raptors just because it'll give them something different. It doesn't mean it'll be a great trade in the long term, but there are things they can do. I think they have to do something. You're in danger of really – it's hard to come back down the number of games they are because, again, it's hard to string together lots of wins in such an even league.
Well, David, they also have the president who has been quoted saying, play in for what? And, yeah, it's a little bit of a different team, and you do have Scotty, who's a younger guy who you probably still want to have reps in those high-leverage spots. But, yeah, I think that ultimately Masai Ujiri wants to win. And, yeah, just coasting through a season or getting into a play-in game is not going to satiate him. The last one on, you know, I do want to move into that thought about OG in a second here. But I do have one more on Barnes, which is just simply, yeah, like the shooting looks somewhat improved, right? He's been a little bit better from three. His free throw shooting has gone up. Usually those are two pretty good markers when it comes to shooting, right? Like those are the two that we use. Even though the field goal percentage is down, he's taken some tougher shots. We still see the kid where when there's 2 feet in the paint, he can create a basket and he can score. But does this surprise you at all, given that part of the reason that you and others were so high on Scotty Barnes, it was just like the motor, right? It was, hey, this motor and the joy for the game. And so the idea of him kind of having, an offseason where it wasn't just, you know, balls to the wall and kind of killing it and trying so hard to take that next step, does that surprise you a little bit, given like everything that we had on the kid heading into that offseason?
Well, it doesn't surprise me only in one way, and that is I have no idea what's happening in his life. I don't know if there's a knee soreness and pain or his mom is sick. There's, you know, these kind of things do happen, and it's hard to play with zeal when you're dealing with that. But when I have watched them play, their half-court offense is just not fun to look at. It's like watching paint dry. It's a lot of side-to-side, get the ball to basically, you know, Pascal can get to the middle against anyone and make a play. And Scotty does that sometimes, but they don't create a lot of easy shots in the half court. They do in the full court. They are in transition. They're, you know, in fast break. That is their style. But there's not a lot of joy in terms of what they do. I'm watching the Jazz this morning on tape. They're still a really fun offense. The Warriors, we call the Jazz offense the blender. I didn't name it that. My company, True Hoop, named the Warriors offense the Cuisinart. I wouldn't even know. Drying paint is what I call the Raptors half-court offense. It isn't built the same. And so this is something that players, coaches have to deal with all the time is our players aren't playing the way we want them to play. What can we do from a system standpoint, a strategy standpoint, to create better situations? Clearly, Pascal can prosper in it. I don't know that anyone else you could argue is really prospering in how they're playing in the half court, and so you have to make some changes. The more stubborn coaches won't change a thing, and I once said the Raptors have their Popovich and Nick Nurse, but you can't go through what they're going through now and feel like this guy's going to be there 15 more years, which is where I thought he could retire there. You've got to be able to pivot. Pop pivoted. The Spurs played different ways over the years. From using the three to pick and roll to 0.5, which is where no one had the ball for more than 0.5 seconds without attacking or passing or shooting. Like they went slow, they went fast. They beat the Heat in their final series by just shooting threes as fast as possible and just try to speed the game up and slow Miami down and get them tired with their big three. Like, you've got to be able to pivot some. Ideology is you know, playing like a dinosaur, same way all the time, will get you extinct. And so you've got to see some changes then. Maybe some changes would help Scotty kind of perk up too. That would be a nice thing.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I thought about that, obviously, you know, that quote of yours heading into talking today. And the way that it relates to me now is like, one, well, I think you nailed it in terms of, yeah, one of the biggest criticisms of Nurse has been inflexibility. And that's been either with utilization of certain players or, yeah, lineups that he's run out there. Or, yeah, I think offensive strategy has been a big one for them. But with Pop, near the, you know, I guess the Spurs start to go into, we're not trying to be a playoff team, we're not trying to be competitive anymore mode, post-Kawhi, like those for last couple of years after DeRozan. And the conversation around him was, is he really going to stick around for a quote-unquote rebuild? And yeah, I think that the Raptors, like we just outlined, that they're not going to lose Barnes and they're not going to lose Siakam. It's pretty hard to envision trades of either of those guys, which doesn't put you in the complete cellar. But if this team does have to take a step backwards and you do go younger, do you start to have similar questions about Nurse's viability or interest in a team like that?
Well, again, I look at it this way. Toronto is, what are they, 13 and 18?
Yep, they're 5 games under .500.
I think Dallas is 15 and 16. You think Dallas is thinking about trading Luka? No, because when you have one of the best players in the world, you keep trying to tweak what's going on and win. I know Siakam is older than Luka and probably not as good. But I say probably. It's Pascal is playing like an All-NBA first-team player. There might be more than five guys doing it, but he's one of those guys. When you have that, forget about all the other guys. When you have that, to decide to trade him, it suggests that your team is bereft of talent everywhere else. That isn't the case. They aren't bereft of talent. We know OG has talent. We know Scottie Barnes is incredibly talented. That's why it makes no sense to me. Instead, you just got to kind of maneuver and rebuild the team in a different way around those guys, at least two of those guys, as well as changing how you play, which is something that happens before. Many times teams will go into training camp playing one way. Very quickly they'll realize, okay, that ain't going to work. We're going to pivot. Or an injury forces you to pivot. And not doing that is where I think the mistake is. So I think if I was a Raptors fan and really cared, I would want to see a change in style rather than a wholesale change in parts, because there's no – you could play 5 more years and 10 more years and not have another Siakam on your team. So that's going to get you the best – that would get you the biggest haul back if they just wanted to go ahead and trade him and then maybe OG for a bunch of young players and picks, which is possible. Absolutely. I mean, if you put this, I'm just making this up, but if you put Siakam on OKC with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, with all the picks, and they probably go after another player or two from you, all of a sudden OKC is fighting for the playoffs. I don't think that's going to happen, but Toronto will be years away from ever being relevant again. And so it just makes no sense to me. I guess it's possible, but I think it's much more likely they just try to come up with some little deals and meet with Nick on how can we play. The great thing about Siakam and Barnes and even OG is they can play a lot of different ways. And so you can change the way you're playing systemically and just bring in different parts to fit in and do something different. They can play much faster when they're playing. If they're not getting a steal, they're not playing as fast. They're not, their offense, like I said, is kind of boring and dry. There's just things they can do. They just have to decide to do it.
Yeah, I cannot see a Siakam trade-in season that isn't some type of unbelievable offer from a team that really does set the Raptors up in a way that is just, it's the Godfather deal, right? It's the one you can't refuse.
Right, the Rudy Gobert deal, yeah.
Yeah,
Masai did with Carmelo when he traded Carmelo. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that trade I don't see coming, but I do see Masai Ujiri identifying some guys like, okay, so you've got Gary Trent Jr. who can opt out of his deal at the end of the year. You've got Fred VanVleet, who can opt out of his deal at the end of the year. Fred's, you know, in his 30s. I think that they have to at least entertain the idea of flipping guys like that into younger pieces, and that's where the Nurse conversation gets interesting to me. Is he's been reluctant to play some younger guys, and he's been reluctant to go through growing pains with some players. And I think that part of the reason that you see that inflexibility at times is because this guy is just desperate to win at like that. He believes in the ways to win, and he's had success doing it in the past. And I mean, like, that is the part to me. That's the interesting part of the equation. Is do you think that he is a guy that should be coaching a team that has a bunch of younger players, even if it is still with a star like Siakam?
Well, you know, I always look at it this way. You guys don't know the NFL as well as we do down here, but I live in the Tampa Bay area.
That's rude, but yeah, okay.
No, I'm complimenting you. I don't watch a down of the NFL. I can't stand the sport. But we had a coach years ago. When I say we, I was a Buccaneer fan when I was young, and we had Tony Dungy. I thought he was a great coach. We fired him. He ended up having amazing success somewhere else, and I didn't feel sorry for him one bit. I feel the same way about Nick Nurse. Nick Nurse is always going to be employed. He's really a great coach. If it doesn't work out in Toronto and they decide to let him go, Earl Watson is well-respected. I don't know him at all, but he's well-respected as a basketball brain who also played. And he probably would play differently than Nick, and Nick would get hired very quickly somewhere else, and everyone would be just fine everywhere. It is that when you've proven yourself the way Nick has, if he isn't willing to go through that, then they're not going to have any problem agreeing to a termination for X amount of dollars, and he'll get hired the next day if he wants by somebody else. That his job is to coach that team. And if he doesn't want to do it, all right, go coach somewhere else. We're fine with that. And they already have a guy that I think all the players respect and like, and I would guess Earl will play much differently. But I don't know why Nick would do that when he does have the kind of talent on the team that he has. If he does decide, I don't want to be here, to me that's a bad sign. There's something wrong with the franchise when you have that situation, which is why I wouldn't expect that to happen. But if it does, it does. Toronto should be just fine either way.
David, again, I always feel smarter after you come on, so I thank you for your time today. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm rooting for you guys. I promise you that.
Thanks, David. Coach David Thorpe, skills and life coach, author at True Hoop, and his book, if you're interested, is called Basketball is Jazz. Okay, so a couple quick takeaways from that I want to rifle through. Yeah, it's been pretty obvious that there's a lot of discussion around what Scottie Barnes' offseason looked like. And I'm really not trying to be radio hot takey here whatsoever. I believe in Scottie Barnes. I think that he is going to be ultimately fine and have a great career. And yeah, David mentioned it. Like, how many guys in the NBA have had this happen? It's not a unique problem. Like, I don't view this as some kind of a huge red flag. But I will say that this is part of the difficulty of trying to say, let's merge the timelines. Like, takes a lot of young guys a while to figure out how to manage a league. Like, he referenced Luka Doncic, right? And I think that it would be quite the stretch to say that Scottie Barnes has a career quite like Luka's is going to be. But look how many years it's taken for Luka to figure out the diet, nutrition, coming into the NBA in game shape part of the equation. It doesn't seem like Scottie Barnes had a great offseason, okay? Maybe he was shooting the ball a ton, but yeah, there have been like a lot of references to complacency from a lot of different places. And yeah, it's hard not to think that when you're having the success that he had last year, man, he showed up in that playoff game against the Sixers and looked awesome and rolled his ankle. He had to feel like he arrived. I don't blame him in some ways for feeling this way. He gets embraced and loved by this city in an incredible way. All of a sudden, he's in more commercials here than Baker Mayfield. It's natural to feel like a little... What is it? Harder to train when you wake up in satin sheets? It's a little bit of that. And maybe this is the kick in the ass that he needed, was a season like this. So again, this is not a long-term doomsday projection, but it's hard not to feel like the offseason for him was not the best. That he maybe wasn't in there grinding and, you know, killing himself every single day the way that other hungrier players have. I don't think that he had the Jason Tatum offseason. But he's also not as old as Jason Tatum and hasn't gone through as much. And that maybe Jason Tatum has had Jason Tatum off seasons or Scottie Barnes level this year off seasons. So yeah, it's a two things can be true. You can be critical of a younger guy and say, damn man, the team needed more from you to have success this year. But also resting the hopes and dreams of a franchise on the shoulders of a 20-year-old is kind of foolish. And that all of us who thought, hey, merge the timeline, maybe this is open, maybe this is a possibility, That part of it was a little overlooked because we thought, hey, we knew already about Scottie Barnes. We already knew, oh, he's dogged. He's going to just show up here and he's going to absolutely make sure that every single day is in the gym and grinding hard and getting better. And yeah, no. Everybody goes through stuff. And David's right. Okay, you don't know everything going on in his personal life. Sure, fine. But ultimately, yeah, it's hard not to look at this and just simply say, that idea, that part of this plan, trying to get the 20-year-old kid to be one of the most important pieces of a contending team was not likely going to work out. And so, yeah, this is where I'm at today. They can't move Siakam. We went over this. Like, no one's advocating for a Siakam trade. You legitimately, man, the irony of them trading him to Oklahoma City after every Raptor fan wanted Shea, would be too much to handle. They'd have to pause the franchise. You don't fold the Raptors, but they go on a year-long timeout. They can't play games. If you're the team that OKC poaches from, that can't happen. Seeing Siakam and Shea lift a trophy, I don't know how Toronto handles that. That's like minus that almost minuses the Kawhi championship. You can't trade Siakam. You obviously can't trade Barnes. The question outside of that is who you trade. To me, I don't like the idea of trading OG Anunoby. He's 25 years old. He's the exact kind of piece that every team in the NBA wants for a reason. I think he's impossibly hard to replicate. I will say, though, that he was just back from injury last night. I do still have questions about he and Siakam fitting well together and what OG wants when he's on a team with Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam. That still could be a conversation. And maybe you get a little proactive with that. Better to do that move now if a team is really willing to spend a ton to get a guy like OG and get the last 2 years of his contract rather than just have him as an expiring and somebody who makes it clear that he's not, you know, overly interested in signing long term unless it's for crazy money, which he's probably going to get anywhere anyway. But yeah, it's at least something to think about. I still think that you look at the guys who can opt out of deals and who just frankly don't fit the timeline, and Fred is one of them. The problem is what David said there about you've got a guy like Siakam. What does that signal to him if you move Fred? Then do you have a disgruntled star on your hands? And then all of a sudden, if you lose Siakam, that's the piece of this, I guess, I think I overlooked to a certain degree in discussing potential Fred trades earlier on, is what that signals to a guy who is unequivocally one of the best 15 players in the NBA, and higher than that, in my opinion. Right now, today, it's hard not to have Siakam when he looks like that and what he's done the last year, not just outside the top 10. I haven't put a list together, but yeah, he's somewhere around that, man. It's an incredibly complicated piece, but it is interesting to hear a guy like David Thorpe, who has been so high on the Raptors and who's been so invested in the Raptors, and you know, in off seasons past, was calling the emergence of Chris Boucher when he was, you know, like a relative nothing in the NBA, and who's been so high on Nick Nurse, and who lauded the Scottie Barnes pick, and who has connections to this franchise, be so down on them and so unsure about where they go next too. Everyone has their one little bit of theory as to what could change, but yeah, now it just feels like more and more scenarios are being laid on the table, which is wild considering the optimism of this fan base when they actually forced their way back into the series against the Sixers a year ago. And yeah, coming even into this season when they didn't even do much during the offseason. Why not? You've always had reason to believe in Masai Ujiri, and you've always had reason to believe in the Raptors since, yeah, basically 2015. You don't have a lot of reason to believe in Baker Mayfield, and But do you have reason to believe in Jalen Hurts' MVP candidacy if he doesn't play the rest of the season? Quick break. Let's come back. Let's explore the fishy lines.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So we've got football games Thursday. We've got football games Saturday. We've got a football game Sunday. We got a football game Monday. NFL really just not screwing around with the Christmas slate this year. And yeah, they've been doing the Christmas Day game stuff in the last couple of seasons or last couple of years. They've come for the NBA. Trying to come for that NBA slate. But if you're the NBA, you got to be thrilled, because what a putrid weekend for the NFL. There's nothing good here. What are you going to watch? You going to really tell your family Christmas dinner night? You're going to go, it's December 25th. It's 8:20 p.m. all right, family, gather around the television so that we can watch the Buccaneers and the Cardinals' third-string quarterback, so that we can watch Tom Brady on the worst team he's ever played for, and the Arizona Cardinals' third-string, Trace McSorley. Oh, the fun we'll have. What a sweet moment for you and the family gathering around. Oh, Boxing Day? Boxing Day, you ask. Oh, could we please watch more of the Colts, Papa? Could we please? Another primetime game for the Colts? Oh, Father, please. I don't want to go out and do a family activity with the Colts on television. We could watch Matt Ryan again in primetime. So fun. So fun. How about these games? Now the Eagles, the Cowboys. Yeah, that was supposed to be a great game. Yeah, it's Gardner Minshew. What else? What do you want to try to find on this slate? What do you want to try to go to that's the number one game of the weekend for everybody? You want to watch that Patriots team against the Bengals? Want to watch the Bills-Bears bloodbath? Where's the game? Where's the game outside of Thursday? Anyway, it's time for action, brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings app to get in on the action. Must be 19 plus. Must be living in Ontario. Please play responsibly. So, yeah, this is Tuesday. We try to go and find the fishy lines. We go and try to find the ones that stand out this week and ask why. First of all, Twitter was ablaze when the injury news or pre-injury news, because the gambling line moved first before Jalen Hurts. It was very UFC of the NFL, where, yeah, the Eagles line went from, I want to say, Cowboys were favored by 1 to the Cowboys were favored by 6 in the matter of moments. It just was instantaneous where it jumped those 5 points. And yeah, you had to figure that was a pretty cataclysmic injury for the Eagles. Something had happened, whatever. And yeah, it turned out to be Jalen Hurts. He's got a sprained shoulder, and there's some buzz that he's not going to play the rest of the regular season. Quick actual take here. He's the favorite for MVP. And to me, the only way this really hurts him is if Gardner Minshew looks, what, 75%? This game, I really believe this game is going to determine the MVP for Hurts. Because if Gardner Minshew goes on the road and beats the Cowboys as 6-point dogs, as +215 underdogs, that's going to hurt Jalen Hurts. People are going to bring that up. People are going to talk about that. People love Minshew mania. They love the antics of Minshew. And they're going to point to this and say, yeah, the Eagles are a really, really good team. Sorry, but he's not the MVP. This is just an awesome team with two elite receivers, a good tight end, an incredible running game, an awesome offensive line, and a defense that lets you play in super advantageous spots. Now, am I saying that I'm actually discrediting Jalen Hurts? No, he's amazing. We have 3 rushing touchdowns last week, all on designed runs for the quarterback. He's clearly special, right? He does. He reminds me of a lot of the things that earlier Russell Wilson reminded me of. A guy that was a dual threat, but way more dangerous with his legs than Wilson was. But a guy that could punish you down the field as well. Like, yeah, he's great. Jalen Hurts is great. I'm just talking about the MVP candidacy. If you're going to beat Patrick Mahomes, who analytically is still pounding everybody else into dust in terms of the types of throws he makes and the wins above average, and I still think Mahomes is being overlooked despite the interceptions. Like, that's even part of it, is that he's so bored that he plays with his food at times and he tries to force throws in. But yeah, he still has to carry his team more than Jalen Hurts does, in my opinion. And yeah, I still think that he is the best in the NFL, and that is his team. If you're going to ask me, hey, your life's on the line, who are you picking? I'm still picking Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. I think his season is a little underrated, and that Niners game should count more than, yeah, pretty much any game that Jalen Hurts has had this season. Either way, that line gets easily explained. So searching and trying to find the other line, right? Where's the other? I don't really understand this. Well, one is the Chargers only being 4-point favorites against the Colts. Like, I did this last week, but I don't understand. I wasn't right, because the Vikings didn't cover. But how are the Chargers, who are starting to roll and get hotter and who are missing guys last weekend, how are they only 4-point favorites? against the Colts and Jeff Saturday, a team that just blew the largest lead in NFL history. Is there some premise here that the Colts being at home after that loss, they're going to play with more pride? I don't understand. I feel like Chargers minus 200 is free money. It's the Chargers, and it's an important spot, but they've had a kicker who's been decent, and their quarterback, Herbert, has been awesome now for weeks. He and Keenan Allen, Mike Williams is healthy. I've said this before, but when Mike Williams is healthy, that's one of the most underrated duos in the NFL. He's just nasty in terms of the catch radius that he has, and the trust between those two guys, the chemistry between those two guys is awesome. Anyway, I don't understand how it's minus four. If you would have asked me to guess Bill Simmons style what that line was, I would have guessed 7.5, 8, that 9, 9.5. I would have gone there closer than some being able to tease this a couple of points and be able to get 2.5. That line makes no sense to me. I can't understand it for the life of me. I'm like scrolling through to see what kind of is Justin Herbert going to potentially miss this game. Mike Williams going to miss this game. That line made no sense to me. I don't like that one whatsoever. I like that line for the favorites. Sounds a little chalky, but it's true. I just doesn't make any sense. The other one is Lions are very short favorites against a Panthers team that, yeah, sure is home and has shown a propensity to stick around the playoff mix, but Lions are good, and they're scratching and clawing to make the playoffs. So there's two short favorites that I like, or that I just don't understand how they're such short favorites. Minus 150 again for the Lions against the Panthers team that just lost to Mitch Trubisky. Couldn't get it going against Mitch. Couldn't get it going against the Steelers team that a lot of people don't think is very good this year. So that one stinks. Don't love the smell of that one.
How about your Seahawks, JD?
No. And then lastly, no, Seahawks are terrible. They don't deserve to be on this. That makes total sense. The Seahawks are really bad. Mahomes is going to carve them up. And yeah, if he wants an MVP award, then that defense is going to be one that he really tries to sink his teeth into. Those are the two fishiest ones. I did think that for a second, the Commanders being 7-point underdogs was a bit rich. But no, the Niners are rolling right now. Maybe the Ravens being 7.5-point favorites against Falcons. I know Ritter was pretty bad and didn't exactly have an incredible debut, but boy, 7.5 points laying with a Ravens team that, yeah, looked pretty lifeless against Cleveland seems like a couple too many points. So those are the only fishy ones. Those are the only ones that stand out to me, but mostly it's those two short favorites. And yeah, there's a lot of just enjoy your family over the holiday season, because I don't know if you're going to miss too much here. Maybe just check in on our Lions, maybe check in on Niners Commanders, Brock Purdy and Tyler Heinicke. That's the highlight of the weekend. Brock Purdy and Tyler Heinicke is what you need to watch on Christmas. That's the one. That's the marquee game. Anyway, that was Time for Action, brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings app to get in on the action. Must be 19 plus. Must be in Ontario. Please play responsibly. Coming up, I had a chance to talk to Patrick Maroon. Going to play that next. So we're in the lull period of the 82-game seasons, right? Raptors not making it feel very lully because, yeah, they're in full crisis mode. But the Leafs, yeah, I think we're starting to settle in. Hey, it's a good team. We're not going to make any wide-sweeping judgments in the moment, except when this team's in town, the Tampa Bay Lightning, tonight, 7 o'clock. I think that we have a pretty good sample that these two teams are pretty even and that these two teams care when they play each other, but that also makes it more interesting. I think that the Leafs will get up. I think that Tampa gets up for this game and that, yeah, these two teams play each other tough. But there is one actual interesting part of this game to me that, yeah, I think projects forward a little bit. And it's not, can Toronto match the physical play of the Tampa Bay Lightning? It's Toronto's leadership, blah, blah, blah. No. It's the goaltending stuff. The one team has Vasilevsky, and the other team has two goaltenders that everyone was riding very high on the last couple of weeks. Everyone has been basically, you know, running victory laps around how the Leafs goalies have played. And, yeah, there's no real reason for pessimism here outside of this. Like, you just had your goalie in Samsonov have his toughest game of the year when the pressure was highest on him personally. It's just one game. It's a one-game sample. But, yeah, a lot of what is going to – what always concerns a goalie and what a fan base is a goaltender that doesn't have the mentals right for big moments and can get down on themselves and can – yeah. Can get a little too locked in on the potential to fail. It was the major talking point with Jack Campbell. So it kicked up a little bit after Samsonov's start against Washington. Mostly brilliant, mostly great, but it has to be noted, okay? That's what we use the regular season for. It's a stress test for what is to come in the postseason. And oftentimes that's not very fun, but for this fan base and for this franchise right now, that's just where they're at, okay? So that's how this is. It's the stress test, and this is a stress test, nice. And the last time Matt Murray played poorly, I would say, wasn't at his best, was against the Lightning. He let in one of his worst goals of the year, unless you're counting the very first game of the season, which you have to, but also kind of shouldn't because it was such a different stretch of his play. But either way, Matt Murray was not great in the first Tampa contest. He wasn't. So I do want to see how he plays tonight, and I hope he plays really well. And that, to me, matters more than just about anything because I know the Leafs are going to stay pretty tough in front of their goalies. I don't think that's going to change. I think that it really says something about their group that we can drop Connor Timmins onto the Toronto Maple Leafs, and he looks like, how did the Coyotes give up this guy? Where did this guy come from, right? It's not a shock that they went out and got another defensive forward, somebody who's a clock killer, and said, yeah, we just want somebody who's physical and can play a little tough and who isn't going to be a bit of a liability or any of a liability. That this seems to be the strategy moving forward. Anyway, this is how the Leafs are going to try to win. But they're going to need the goalies to make the easy ones, which they've mostly been doing, which they have been doing at an incredible, incredible clip. Ton of reason for optimism, but still, these stress test games, this is where it's going to matter. The stress test games are where it's going to really matter for the goaltending. Not the easier nights, the nights where you face your former team, the nights where there's a big story around you, the nights where you didn't face a group before and play very well, or when you're going to be facing a group that you're going to be potentially seeded against in round one of the postseason. So anyway, big Matt Murray night. Patrick Maroon, got a chance to talk to him yesterday after practice. He got off the ice. He sat down with me for about 20 minutes. It was really gracious of him. I'm going to play that interview now. Been trying to make this happen for a while. Very excited that it's happening. Lightning forward, three-time Stanley Cup champion, Pat Maroon. How we doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for doing this. So last time I talked to you, it was after you guys had, I think, when did you guys do the Canal Stanley Cup championship? Was that last year? Or, was that the first cup with Tampa, or was that the second one?
We did the both.
Okay, well, either way, yeah. I talked to you in the middle of it, like your run, and you're a gracious guy for coming on. There's no doubt about it. But, yeah, you had like a crappy phone. I think that your agent was like, I think he threw a phone out the window. Like, it wasn't the easiest to get a hold of you.
I think I broke my phone, so it didn't work for a while.
Yeah, you had a broken phone. It was a whole thing. You came on, but it was still electric, man, because you came on. You were obviously buzzing after another win. Your team did great. It was one of those times, too, where we're loosening up a little bit. You guys actually got to do something outside of the pandemic other than just, you know, play hockey and see the same teammates every single time. And, yeah, it was a blast.
That's
so
true.
Yeah, I think I'll probably get you in like a little bit of a different circumstance today.
Yeah, just a little bit. A little more sober.
Yeah, a little bit. That was the other part. I was like, this is amazing. He's just going to fly and do this. You know, one thing I do remember about that conversation, though, and I'll get this one out of the way, but you, at that time, you didn't have a contract, right? And you were a highly sought-after commodity, man. Like, you had just won. Like, you'd been racking up wins, and everybody was looking for basically what you were bringing. And I remember just quickly you saying, hey, was Toronto on the radar? I'm curious, did they ever actually end up going down the line with you, or did you lock things up with Tampa Bay so quickly that really nobody had a chance to get in?
Yeah, I locked up with Tampa right away. Toronto never reached out.
Yeah,
I don't think we even made it that far. I think, we locked it up right before free agency. So, I wanted to stay in Tampa. The city is great. The team's awesome. And it's been a special group to play with the last 2 years. So no one really reached out. Toronto did not reach out. I wish I could stir the pot and say they did.
Yeah. I wish so too. Like, you know who really wishes? Me. That would have been great for you to say it. Like, yeah, you know what they did, but I thought they stunk and I didn't like the offer, so forget about it. That would have been much better than like, yeah, no, the team that liked me and I was happy with and the place that's awesome to play that keeps winning hockey games and that paid me the actual value on a contract, I figured that was a pretty good mix. Yeah, seems like you made a pretty decent choice. Okay, so 5 wins in a row for your group. You got, you personally, 4 straight cups. You as a group now, a couple of them. How do you guys manage a regular season? Like, I'm always so curious because, like, the NBA, you have guys who obviously end up taking nights off. So much of today's modern sports is about load management and making sure that you can get to a finals. And I do remember, and this was talking to some people that were, I don't want to say around your group as in from your team, but people who cover the Lightning last season. And there was some belief that the group was starting to wear down and that it was starting to take its toll come the end of the year. So I really am curious, especially for like a physical guy like yourself, how you guys find different ways of maintaining success year over year and still manage to find, you know, time to win these regular season games.
Well, I just think when you have such a special group for so many years and doing so many special things together as of winning the Stanley Cup, you know, I'm a firm believer. You know, we've kind of have a bad taste in our mouth from last year losing to Colorado because, you know, without Braden Point, Cirelli too. I mean, guys like that that can enter in your lineup that can be a huge impact, and losing injuries, I felt, you know, but we got banged up down the stretch. But I think for us, we're just so excited to play every single night. We have a good group. We know how to play the right way. We love playing the right way. I think it's good in the room that we all know, and, you know, when we make mistakes, we all hold each other accountable. So I think just the excitement in the room, but also I think the window, you know, closes so fast, and, you know what I mean? We don't know if this group is going to be together for, you know, the next 2 years. So you just got to get that excitement and want to win, and our team wants to win, you know, and that's what's cool about this team. There's no passengers. Everyone pulls on the same rope. And, you know, and I think once we got a taste of it, we wanted more. You know, you want to get greedy at that point. And last year we ended short. But I think that's, you know, there's that bad taste still. So I think we want to, you know, find a way to get back there and achieve our goal again. And that's what I love about this team.
Obviously, you're describing self-motivation, that you guys get it as a group. Like, there's a lot of veterans, there's a lot of winners in the room, so it's easy to understand what you just said, right, about wanting to win. But did you guys – it seemed like you caught wind of that a little bit going into the playoffs last year, that people were starting to say this isn't the same Lightning group and maybe they are worn down. Did that motivate you?
Say that again. Sorry, you cut out.
I was saying, did that motivate you as a group? Did that get into your guys' room? Had you heard that? Because, yeah, you often see champions use, you know, the chip on the shoulder thing. And I was saying that you guys clearly have a lot of internal motivation in a group with a lot of winners. But having people question whether or not you could still do it physically, that whether or not you guys would hold up after so many long runs, did that give you guys any added motivation heading into the postseason last year? Or
yeah,
into this
for sure. Listen, people are going to say what they need to say. I mean, they said we looked tired, and you know, in the Toronto series, we found a way. And I think with our team, the longer the series goes on, I think we're the team that finds a way that, you know, we're the team that's going to do it the longest, right? If we can find a way to back them up in the corner, we can do it longer than them. I think we like our odds, and I don't. You know, media obviously saying we look tired or sluggish, but, you know, once you put those skates on, you know, you try to do the best of your ability. Listen, we try to win game 6 against Colorado and bring the game 7. Mm-hmm. Maybe we didn't have enough, you know, enough steam to, you know, pull it off. You know, it was meant to be for Colorado to win. But I think for us, you know, it just motivates us with all the noise that goes on with it. And, you know, you read that stuff, you're like, we're not tired. So, and we know what we need to do. You know, it's all up in your head, you know, mentally and physically. And you just try to, you know, pull on the same rope together and, you know, do it together. You know, we lose as a team, you win as a team.
But I can tell you one thing is I had people on my show asking them about it heading into your postseason matchup together. I'm not doing that this year. It won't be brought up on my show. I'm not helping.
You know, like, I'm not doing my part with these questions. All I'm going to talk about is how great you guys look and the chip on the shoulder. That's all that's going down this time around. You know, the other thing I find really fascinating with your group and, like, with you specifically is – so I've had a bit of a gripe recently with just the cap league and how it's been flat for a couple of years right now, and that it really does seem to be that the league is going a little bit more a direction of uniformity when it comes to player types. And that, yeah, the game is starting to lose a bit of its physicality, and it's starting to lose what I think is special about teams like yours, which is you get familiar with the group, right? And there is a chemistry that grows, and you have lines that do different things. And that does remind me of being more early 2000s, before the cap, late 90s, where, you know, fans would know who was on the third line of the great teams. And there is less of that in today's game. And I wonder how much pride you guys take as a group that your bottom six has a clear-cut identity. And, yeah, that the contributions that you get throughout your lineup, that it isn't just a top-heavy group.
Yeah, for sure. You nailed it there. I mean, I think I disagree with the game going the opposite way. I think you need toughness in your lineup. I think you need guys that are there to make your team look bigger. You know, the feels, you know, the other guys on the bench to make them feel like they're a little bit bigger too. So, but back to your question is, you know, I just feel like with our third line and fourth line, we all know we all have a job to do, and the job is, you know, get pucks in, get pucks out, you know, play the right way, making sure, you know, we're doing it. And, you know, playing below the top of the circles, grinding them down low, being physical. I think once you have that, everyone, you know, it's, you know, some will say it's boring, but it's simple hockey. And if you can do that and, you know, chip away at it and, you know, wear on their D and set the next line up, I think you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's been working for you guys. Yeah, the physical play stuff, though, has been really interesting this season in particular, because I'm sure you've seen a lot of the Trouba highlights. He's been laying some pretty big hits. And it feels like a lot right now. There's a big open ice hit, and then there's a response from a team where there's a fight, there's a scrum, there's something else. And again, I don't know how much of this is between players, but I have heard people say this where, all right, if guys are reacting this way to every single big hit, is this the way that we want the league to be going? And do we need to try and legislate some of these hits out? I just wonder what you feel and how you think most guys feel about where physical play and where hitting is going in the NHL.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a hard topic. I mean, I don't know. Like, listen, if someone gets blown up and, you know, I'm on the ice, obviously I'm going to stick up for my teammate. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, with the hitting and stuff, I mean, I don't know. That's just a unique question to answer. I just feel like I think hitting is a really – I mean, it's – well, one, you got to get your head up too. You know, obviously, mm-hmm. You guys got to keep their elbows down and obviously clean hits. But it's so big for the game, hitting, and obviously it gets guys engaged into the game. And I feel like, yeah, obviously you don't have to fight every time someone gets blown up, but I feel like you need to have that, you know, someone that is willing to do it, and you know, you have someone on your bench that, you know, is protecting some of the guys that do get hit.
So obviously I love the skill in the game. There's just no doubt about it. But it is funny that so many people my age grew up and the title of the tapes that we, you know, watched on hockey trips and watched on buses was Rock 'em Sock 'em. And it was the idea of just, you know, the importance of physical play in hockey. And you see it throughout the playoffs, and you see it as games intensify, it actually being there. I don't think hockey's ever going to become a sport where there is no hitting. But yeah, I do worry sometimes that with the complete emphasis on skill that we lose a little bit of the focus on the fact that, again, it gets back to the hard cap thing, that it's nice having a lot of diversity in the game, that there is hitting, that there is skill, that there is toughness, you know, that there is speed, that all of those elements combined is what makes hockey great. And yeah, I don't know, man, I've felt a little worried recently with just some of the discourse and some of the things people have said, and yeah, some of the worries that we have moving forward. And yeah, I think as long as players care about it, then it's going to be fine. But yeah, maybe it is just a little bit more media noise. Did you guys, like, you must have felt like you had the physical edge in the Toronto series last year.
I mean, yeah, I feel like we had it. I feel like all of our lines kind of hit. All of our lines played a gritty game, and I feel like we had the upper hand on that side of it. Mm-hmm.
What was the hardest part about playing them last year? Like, what do you think it is the toughest really part about their matchup now?
I think the toughest, you know, they have good speed. You know, they can hurt you off the rush. They can, you know, they can kill you if you turn pucks over. They got a lot of offense. They're fast to get up in the play. I just thought they were a really fast-paced team, and they pushed the pace really good against us. I thought they gave us a really good run. That series could have went either way. And like I said, if you do it longer and you do it the right way for, you know, 60 minutes or whatever that may be, I think the team that does it the best and longer and is willing to dump punks in and take risk out of their game, I think that's how you win series, and I feel like we did that.
Yeah, it was a great series, and you're right. It could have gone either way. A lot of people here, like, we hate the playoff format, that it is always, you know, basically, hey, it's going to be Tampa, Toronto, or Boston in some variation that's going to have to play each other in the first round. That's too good of teams. Do you like the format?
I mean, no, not really, because, you know, a good team can get knocked out right away in the first round.
Yeah.
But I guess that's part of it. You know, two good teams are going at it right out of the gate. But, you know what, it's different. It brings a different look for people. And, you know, the first round's usually the hardest.
I just never thought the first round was a problem. I just, like, the first round's always great. People always watch the first round. You're up against the NBA, which is the worst round of that. Like, it's physical. Most guys are as fresh as they're going to be throughout the run. So the idea that it's like you have to have some of the best teams playing each other, I've never really liked that so much. All right, last one from me. Speaking of just, like, intense competitions, I don't know how much you paid attention to the World Cup, but do any of you guys, and I, especially for American guys like you, how much you reflect on hockey not having best on best in a meaningful way for almost 10 seasons? And like watching, yeah, the international reactions around the world and just how many people kind of gravitate towards an event like this when it's wrapped in the flag. Just sort of the loss, especially for a golden generation of American players to just have not had anything on the major stage for almost a decade.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the World Cup. That was one of the best games I've ever watched in my entire life. I think that was one of the best sporting games I've seen live from start to finish. I think it sucks. Yeah, international play. I mean, everyone's tuned in and watching the game yesterday at 10 in the morning. Yeah, I think we need international play. I think we need best-on-best hockey. I think the fans, you know, want to see it. I think the players want to see it. I think even the players want to do it, so... it's been a long time since that has happened, and, you know, we're obviously really looking forward to getting back to that.
Do you think the States has got screwed the most?
The States?
Yeah, like the Americans, because it's just like, this is the best lineup that you hear routinely from Canadian fans. Like, it's fine, because look how good America would be.
Yeah, they'd be good. I mean, but then you go to Canada, then you don't know. I mean, there's guys that should be on the team, probably not even on the team.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, with McDavid, McKinnon, Bergeron, I mean, Marchand, I mean, you can just go down the list, Braden Point. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't even know U.S.'s lineup, Austin Matthews, Jack Eichel, mm-hmm. Matthew Tkachuk, Brady Tkachuk, I don't even, Patrick Kane.
Yeah, no, I mean, pretty good, man. It's getting pretty good.
It's like a good Robertson, lineup, yeah. Yeah, it's getting really good.
It's getting insane. Like, again, I've never, ever, ever looked at a lineup compared to Canada's in my life and gone, that's better than us. And I think that yeah. The States lineup for the first time ever is actually, it's right there. It's comparable. You look at net, you look at the blue line, you look at across the board. And that's what I think about stuff like this. Like, it's so important for growing hockey. We always talk about growing the game, growing the game, growing the game. It's like, look at what international sports does for it. And look how good the Americans could have been. What a moment it could have been if they ended up winning and being in tight series with the Canadians. Pat, I appreciate you making time today. Always fun getting to chat. Thanks for making it, man.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys. Enjoy your day.
Take care, dude. Pat Maroon, Lightning forward, 3-time Stanley Cup champion.
I hate how good America looks on paper. I think it's hilarious that Maroon hasn't really thought about their roster. He's like, I'm not a part of this, so I'm not really thinking about who is on the team. I got my own winning to do. They've got Connor Hellebuck in net, who some people are projecting to be... This is just crazy conversation. I saw David Amber and Chris Pronger talking about whether or not he, you know, like what awards he could end up winning this year. It's beyond the Vezina. But just for a little bit of, hey, this is what the States have been missing. The Tkachuk brothers, Matthews, Goudreau, Eichel, Kane, Kyle Connor, Jack Hughes, Jason Robertson, Alex DeBrincat, Jake Gensel. Like, it's a pretty long ass list of scary. Matty Beniers is now taking a step. And yeah, the strange one is that, like, now the blue line has a ton of guys. Trouba, McAvoy, Fox, also Hughes. Basically, they're just going to make the team out of the Hughes guys. Slavin, Carlson. Whew, it's a lot. 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 So, yeah, you look at their cut list, it's good players. Anyway, it's not like Canada wouldn't be favored in the tournament. It's not like we wouldn't win. Just saying that for the first time ever, there's actually a roster of Americans that you could look at and say, oh, that might be just about as good as us. Oof. Not quite, but just about. There was always a hole with somebody else's roster, right? There was always, oh, their blue line stinks. Oh, they don't have any forward depth, or they don't have any scoring depth, or usually goaltending was the equalizer always. With international play, everybody always had a good goalie, but... Yeah, no. If it ever returns, which it probably never will because, yeah, the NHL just doesn't seem to care, whatever. They just won't. So eventually we'll figure it out. Eventually. Like maybe 2025. Maybe 2026. Someday we'll do this thing that the rest of sports deems to be incredibly important. Maybe someday we will. Grow the game. Grow the game. Unless it makes us uncomfortable in any way. Then no. Can we make tons of money off it? Is it completely easy for us? Oh, okay. Then maybe we'll do it. But probably not. Russia. It's hard. I'm tired of it. Make it happen. Do you guys, obviously, the drone shots, I posted a video yesterday of it when Donovan was talking about the drone shots from Argentina. It's going to be really hard to talk about any of the parade stuff or the celebration stuff in any city in North America this year. For Super Bowl parade, who's going to win? Bills? Leafs win a Stanley Cup? I'm trying to think about the teams where the markets where it would matter the most. Obviously, this isn't close, but yeah. Who's going to win an NBA championship where we get to see that? Yeah, it's going to just feel a little watered down. Toronto would probably get the closest in terms of the Argentina vibe of just people going nuts. And I still, like, I was there during the Raptors parades. I was there both nights downtown when they beat the Bucks to go to the finals and everyone lost it. Not nearly the kind of scene, but yeah, still got pretty jammed up in certain spots downtown. People were jumping on some cars. There were some delays that evening. There wasn't the bus that got completely hollowed out down at Young and Dundas, where it was like the lost boys, just people sitting on hollowed out buses waiting for the people to come and clear those out. I think Argentina probably, yeah, a lot crazier. I'm not trying to compare the two in terms of directly, but yeah, that's the one that there's the most stakes. I want to feel that. That joy that we felt in Vancouver. That national pride that's been gone for a pretty long time. Anyway, we're late. We got to take a quick break. Got to come back and talk to Sid Sixero, a BT. How does he feel about the Messi discourse for the last 24 hours? And has he checked his mentions? That's next.
Sportsnet 590.
So normally the takes come out in the heat of the moment. Everybody's got to have the opinion to take. What is it? And it was, hey, Messi's the greatest of all time now. That was the greatest game ever. Some people think it's the greatest tournament ever. It certainly is for FIFA. I heard yesterday they made $7.5 billion, B with a B, billion, over the four-year cycle, and over $1 billion in excess profit during that four-year cycle. So they think it's great. They are very stoked on this tournament. They are no regrets on Qatar for them. Anyway, Sid Sixero, Breakfast Television, one of the absolute best, the heartbeat of soccer. For this show, and I still think for this station. Did you, listen, I know you're not a guy who checks the mentions, but did you have to at least take a quick little peek? Did you have to take a little peek after Messi won?
Yeah, I checked the mentions. Yeah. By the way, if I'm the heartbeat of soccer in the country or at the station, we need to fit it.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
We have some great, you know what, though? Soccer, like, I feel the one thing I do like about tournaments now is I can talk to you and other hosts and do other shows, and I don't think we have to dumb down a thing. Like, maybe you didn't watch Canada throughout qualifying, but yeah. No, but listen, I remember a time when young J.D. Bunkus was on air in the big market of Toronto and was like, I'm not doing soccer.
Yeah.
I have no care for soccer. I have no interest in soccer.
Now that's tennis.
I don't want to hear about soccer. Yeah. It's like, oh, bloody big deal. I don't care. Don't care. No, don't want to talk about it. Now, we can, like, I just feel like the IQ's up. Yes, true. But I just feel like the IQ's up. I feel like it's a different conversation now than it used to be. It really is. Don't get me wrong. I still get wound up. But it was fun. It was a fun tournament, man. Good thing. FIFA really got theirs. They really learned a lesson in this tournament.
No, they did. They really learned. Jeez. They said, they're like, where's it going soon? And they went, guess where it's going? Saudi Arabia. That's where it's going. It's gonna stick around. We like the $7.5 billion. Everyone went, oh my God, we're so outraged by all of these different things. And then they went, we made $8 billion. We're more powerful than ever. And yeah, all you're talking about is Messi, which is exactly what we had hoped for. Anyway, no, I totally get your – you got to feel a little bit of pride in the country, Sid, because, yeah, this is your sport. And it reminds me a little bit of when I started seeing Raptors watch parties in 2019 crop up in places like, Edmonton and Vancouver. And I grew up in Western Canada. And if you said that you liked the Raptors or you liked the NBA during, the early 2000s, late 90s, it was basically you saying you hated hockey or that, you were taking some kind of a hardcore stance. And that you were very different to like those sports. And so, I think that soccer is having a bit of a moment like that right now in the country where, more and more people are being educated about the sport, more people are falling in love with it. And ultimately, I think that you're like me in the sense of I've never thought of the idea of bandwagon fans being bad. I think about it as being great. I love being connected to more sports fans and having, a passion grow in the country. I think it puts more pressure on those institutions and teams to win. And I think that it helps us connect on something that we all kind of care about or have the same rooting interest in, which is, getting, I think, a little rarer these days.
For sure. And I think, and some of those bandwagon fans, let's remind everyone, are TV executives.
Yeah.
So if people above us,
not here,
in the media
the
world,
best.
Well, there, no, but I'm just saying, like, there's nothing wrong with an executive's eyes opening up to something.
Sure.
Like, I remember, listen, I wasn't in that exact seat as yours. I was in a different part of the building. But I remember when the Raptors weren't that hot. And so do you.
Yeah.
And the conversations were, okay, what's it going to take? What's it going to take for some more resources to go into this? What's it going to take for the ratings to go up? Blah, blah, blah. In Canada, it's now the easiest formula to work out. You win. Mm-hmm. That's it. You win. Like, the ratings, did you see the ratings for Canada-Croatia compared to the World Cup final Sunday? Did you see that?
Yeah, that is insane. Everybody wants it like this. Yeah,
but the fact that Canada Croatia got more than the World Cup final is yet another example of how stupidly easy it is to program Canadian television on a sports level, have Canada involved. Mm-hmm. Like, in no way should Canada Croatia outdraw that game Sunday. Shouldn't happen, but in Canada it does. And it goes to any other sport. It goes to World Juniors. It goes to Olympics. It is what it is. So and that was the only thing that kind of it didn't disappoint me. I expected it, but that game Sunday was so nuts. I was still a little surprised a group stage game outdrew it. I was a little surprised, but the power of Canadians rooting for Canada, it's undeniable. You can't beat it. Can't beat
power
it.
Of that. Power of that. I also think that the time on the East Coast being 10 a.m. will that one will always hurt, right? On an NFL Sunday and just, yeah, it's like, what time is this game? I don't think that it's the – if you put that game maybe at 4 o'clock.
Well, that was when Croatia went to play Canada. They played them at 10 o'clock.
Right, but that's scheduled viewing where you're going like, hey, we're all watching this, like we're Canadians. I just feel like, yeah, there was – you know what hurt it too, in my opinion, is the semifinals being just non-factors, non-need-to-watchers because everybody knew what the final was going to be when it was hit the semifinal. Morocco was a great story. Croatia was a great story.
Yeah.
But yeah, if we had gotten Argentina-Brazil in the semifinal, I think it would have kept the momentum for the Messi story. And then you started to get the weird stuff of like, hey, it's rigged, and all these guys coming out and saying like, this is a predetermined result around soccer. And yeah, I think that, yeah, there was a little bit of lost momentum from that point forward. But you're right, that this is always going to be a place where you're going to watch the Canadian team more than you're going to be watching the final. I think even now, even with that kind of final, that is kind of, I don't want to say damning, because ultimately it's been real momentous for soccer, but yeah.
And 3.9 million is still a hell of an average audience in this country.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong. Like, that's staggering.
Yeah.
I when you compare it to other moments in the tournament, I do find it interesting, though. That's kind of my only point, but I'm not surprised by it.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised by it. But overall, it was, as much as I hate to say this, because apparently karma works for everyone except for FIFA. it was a crazy on-field tournament, man. It is what we thought it could be. Everyone's coming in shape. Everyone's coming in peak form, aside from a few superstars. And you saw it play out. And the refereeing wasn't really that bad. There were no, like, the controversial moments, which always exist, really didn't exist. I had no issues with any of those Argentina penalties. I'm sorry, I didn't. I had zero cause to complain. And it was a weird on the level kind of World Cup. You don't always see them, but we got that too. It was just, as a soccer fan, it was great. As a lover of the game, I was also kind of a little horrified for obvious reasons, but it was crazy. I'll always remember it. We'll always remember it for sure.
No, it was a great tournament. And it's funny, the discourse between the soccer casuals like me versus the soccer hardcores like you and Joe, who works on the show, when it came to the Argentina penalties, could not have been further apart. Like, that first one that they gave, I went, oh, okay, yeah, the fix is totally in. And they're going, oh, it's the clipping, it's the thing. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, let's look at these penalties. And then the diehards are like, these are the FIFA rules. These are the ones. These are correctly called. You're an idiot. And I'm like, all right, fine. I'll accept being an idiot, but I'm still going to hate it. Okay, so the Messi discourse over the last 48 hours. You feel the same? Like, the greatest of all time is just a huge thing. But yeah, you stack it all up with all the individual awards, the league success, and now kind of this coup de grace. Yeah, it actually does feel like it's hard almost to have that take. We entered into the discussion of, is he the greatest athlete of all time conversations. Like, how have you just felt about the discourse? Anything you change?
And not to rip anyone who's gone down this road, because I get it. Greatest athlete of all time over various sports is the dumbest thing you can ever walk into. I encourage anyone to not get suckered into that discussion.
Donovan and I did it for 20 minutes yesterday.
Please, please never do it again.
Yeah, we had
because
to.
Unless anyone on the list can beat Usain Bolt, it's not a conversation.
Okay, I like that.
I just don't. It's like, if we're going to talk about greatest soccer player, like, let's at some point have apples next to apples. Mm-hmm. At some point, like, let's not completely, because then you dilute the conversation from what we just saw. Mm-hmm. What we just saw was someone say, "I want this title, and I'm going to do this." And if anyone now doesn't think I'm the greatest soccer player of all time, I'd love to hear why. Mm-hmm. And you can have that conversation. You can talk about it. Now, I still don't know how long that conversation would be, considering all the Champions League titles he's won, all the La Liga titles he's won, Players of the Year awards he's won, mm-hmm. and now this. There's not a trophy cabinet in the history of the game that looks like it. It doesn't exist. Ronaldo's close. He's missing this. So I'm not the biggest fan of greatest athlete, and we ignore decathletes, and we ignore... Mm-hmm. Like, these amazing people who've done amazing things. Like, I just, it's not a discussion that interests me. What interests me is how this guy, knowing full well this was it, this was his last shot at this, did it. And he did it with the weight, never mind the critics. Like, he would have, crucified's a strong word, but Argentina would not have been happy if they went out in the round of 16. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Like we ran some live shots from Buenos Aires during the show here on Breakfast Television today. That was the most pressure he was facing was from back home. And the fact that he did it, it's a staggering move. It really is. And he had to beat some real teams to do it. And I don't think Argentina were that good. But he found a way to elevate. And I think that makes him the greatest.
Yeah. To me, the craziest part was when the team looked like they were falling apart, and man, you blow a 2-0 lead, and you just see how that normally affects teams across all sports, where you think you've got a title or you think you've got a huge win in hand, and it just changes the way that your team plays. And he never changed, right? He still continued to get opportunity after opportunity that he created for himself, and that's kind of going to be my lasting memory from him. And okay, so yeah, greatest athlete, greatest player, right? Greatest player seems like it's kind of locked down. My curiosity is, do you think that in, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30 years, that his name resonates the way that Pelé's does today?
Yes, because the one thing that really dawned on me during this tournament is, take all the Argentinian soccer fans in the world and put them in one arena. You're going to need another 7 arenas just for the Messi fans, because they're not the same. They're different. And I have to say, and I don't want to disrespect anything, because I saw it globally, around the world, in England specifically, in Canada, everywhere. The gushing over Messi from neutral analysts is something I've never seen for another player. I've never seen it, ever. And the fan base of people who didn't have any skin in the game for Argentina, but just wanted him to win, was staggering. I've never seen anything like that. Fans, media, social media, across the board. And that should give you the reach. His reach was different. He was operating with different Wi-Fi. He was touching people in a different way. Now, I kept seeing him fail internationally, so I wasn't suckered into it for a long time. But the way he played at Barca, the way he did certain things, his fan base was incredible. And I'll always take away how many Argentinian fans and non-Argentinian fans wanted this. Like Kylian Mbappe, the list of hat tricks in the World Cup final is 2 guys. 2. And the kid who just did it just turned 24 today. It's one of the greatest soccer accomplishments I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it's been completely swept under a rug. It's gone. Yep. It doesn't exist until we talk about the next tournament. That was the power of the media response to Messi. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was there, but when I saw it really projected in this tournament, I went, wow. Mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared for how it was at this level. When everyone knew this was it for him, I wasn't prepared for that level of love. And it was incredible to watch. And the impact he's made is undeniable. Ronaldo was never going to be loved the way this guy is loved. And that's why Ronaldo hasn't posted anything yet, I'm pretty sure. Because that's a whole other discussion. But the media's reaction specifically to this, I couldn't believe. I couldn't believe it. It was quite something.
Well, I think the thing is, we all want to see the storybook, I don't want to say endings, because he's still going to have a career. I even still continue to wonder. He'll be 39, right, by the time it's next World Cup?
Don't do it. Don't do it, JD.
We guys always do this, and they say it, and then it's like Tom Brady, right? And we live in the era of longevity, and guys, I could see him coming back and it happening and it not being the storybook ending, and then he ends up tainting it a little bit because they struggle or they lose or he's not great or whatever. But anyway, this is a great moment just because, yeah, everybody can understand it, right? It's, hey, this is the greatest player and he just won the biggest tournament. Like, you can connect that to any person. It's the easiest story to sell, and it actually happened. And so feeling like you're a part of that is a powerful feeling. I felt it too. Like, I had a bet on France going into that game, and guess what? Like 10 seconds in that game, I went, oh my God, I can't believe I bet this side. I desperately want to see Argentina win because I'm a sports fan and I want to see him win, right? Like, I just went, what am I going to tell my great grandkids that I'll never have about? Am I going to tell them about France winning back to back World Cups, or am I going to tell them about the greatest player who ever lived and how he won a World Cup? And yeah, it's just, that is powerful. So I can totally understand why media and why people and why casuals and everyone jumped on that wagon. I never thought that in sports we would have more Michael Jordans and Pelés, because I thought that those guys had the advantage of myth, right? that we didn't watch and scrutinize the same way over the course of an entire career. We didn't have every like little piece of the film of these players. And so the myth helped create it. And there's something about being, you know, the first mega star in a sport that translates globally. And that's the thing I find fascinating about Messi is he going to be the first guy that just, you know, usurps the other ones when it comes to names? Is he going to be, when you think of the soccer, the first name you think of is Messi over Pelé? That to me is like, that's possible, right? Like that's going to maybe happen 50 years from now. That's wild to me.
I think it's happening now.
Yeah.
It's going to happen 50 years from, listen, unless there's the next one. And in sports, there's always the next one. But to do this at the highest level in the world's most popular sport is a pretty special thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you're right, Pelé, like part of the Pelé's mystique too, you're right. Like he never went to Europe. It was a different time. There wasn't as much exposure. Mm-hmm. And with Maradona, there was a bit more of it, but it was similar. And these were also the few times you could actually see them play with consistency. So you fell in love with them quicker. But with Messi, yeah, like we will be looking at him for a long, long time above a lot of the greats. I hope he never plays another World Cup game. You cannot be that stupid to think you can top that. You cannot be that stupid. The only thing that went wrong is Salt Bae tried to take your trophy. Yeah. That's it. Like, you can't come back. Tom Brady.
He's Turkish. I thought he was Argentinian doing this. I went, oh, like, he must be a huge guy.
I had no idea where he's from. All I knew
he's Turkish. How did he get on there?
I see, that's the thing. People are mad at him. I get it. But someone let him on the field.
No, I know.
Whoever
let him on the field, Sid, just when he started seeing the clips, I hope he was a king. I hope he was someone with just untouchable power, because if that guy can be scrutinized whatsoever, whoever let Salt Bae on the pitch, you had to be sweating it out. When he grabbed Messi's arm and you saw that highlight and you knew you were directly responsible for that, like, yeah. I think you fleed. I think you flee the country. I think that
he's so delusional. He loved every second of it. Like, yeah. I don't know how influencers like that work. I don't understand. Yeah. But I hope Messi's done. I really hope this is the last we see of Messi in a World Cup. He has been given a gift from the soccer gods. He earned it, but it was also a gift. This rarely happens in sport. Tom Brady completely screwed it up. Tom Brady should have walked after that Super Bowl. Walked. Look at Belichick now. It's a joke. Walk after that Super Bowl, and you will have statues in every NFL city. Every NFL city, just because. If Messi comes back to another World Cup, see, that's the thing. Messi's 35. Ronaldo knows what life is like at 37. Mm-hmm. Messi doesn't know that yet. I hope he doesn't find out. Let him go out to pasture and enter Miami and make his money. Nothing wrong with that. Zero wrong with that. Messi has been given one of the rarest opportunities in sports. Leave on top at a World Cup level. I hope we never see him again. Because he doesn't have to come back. He's done enough for his country. He's done enough for his teammates. He's proved it to himself and to other people like me. His job is done. If he can put the ego aside, it'll be one of the great sporting stories of all time. If he comes back and looks slow, it is what it is.
100%. Sid, we got to run. We're up against it. But as always, thanks for the time, buddy. It was really fun getting to chop it up today. See you, pal.
See you, brother. Take care, guys.
Subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, do all of those things, share it, be kind, and I'll catch you tomorrow.